Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It's spring break season with plenty of all-inclusive deals inviting you to relax in some sunny, safe destination. There are educational and charitable vacations, extreme action packages, and for those seeking a different kind of thrill, drug tourism. Tours to Amsterdam, Indonesia, and Peru allow vacationers to indulge in substances illegal here in the U.S. Drugs and vice are big money makers for these countries. In Peru, drug tours may also be helping to preserve the rainforest. Christine Sismondo traveled to Peru to experience this growing industry for herself and wrote about it for the Smart Set. And a quick note first to parents and sensitive listeners. We are in no way endorsing using drugs, but we're going to hear a firsthand account of an experience in a place where use is legal and part of a long cultural tradition. So with that out of the way, hello, Christine.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. Really excited to talk to you about this. We know Amsterdam for its hash bars, Southeast Asia for various different kinds of drugs and vices, among other things. So what is it that's luring people to Peru?
Peru actually has more than just the ayahuasca, which I wrote about. Peru has a number of drugs that are illegal in other places that have been kept legal there for cultural reasons. So the first one would be coca tea, which is not really white powder cocaine or anything close to that, but it helps people adjust to the altitude. And they're under a fair bit of pressure to make that illegal from the United Nations. And the second one is a form of mescaline called San Pedro, which people in the Andes drink. It's a cactus that sort of melted down and turned into a tea. And the third is, of course, the ayahuasca, which is more common in the rainforest. And the indigenous people there drink that also sort of like a tea and experience a long, protracted high.
Well, tell us a little bit more about the history and the tradition of using ayahuasca.
I think that the thing that's sort of important to note about all of this isn't like a weekend party drug to the people who are using it. It's the guide that we had, we spent about a week with a guide in the rainforest, and his name was Oscar, and he was absolutely fantastic. He had grown up there. His uncle was a shaman. His father was a shaman. And he had, I think, taken ayahuasca four times in his life. They tend to do it during periods when you're either sort of mentally stressed or physically ill. And it's almost a diagnostic tool.
What do you mean a diagnostic tool? It just sort of points out what you need help with or what's wrong?
Exactly. The shaman uses it to try to identify what's wrong mm-hmm. with the person that he's helping to heal.
We're talking with Christine Sismondo about the growing trend of ayahuasca use in Peru, where it is legal and it's being sold as part of vacation packages for ecotourism companies there. And as far as drugs go, ayahuasca has not been a household name. You know, certainly it's not a street drug. But you're observing that things are changing. And how so, and why do you think that is?
It sort of hit the cultural consciousness. It's interesting because it was about 50 years ago that it first sort of became noticed by people like William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg. And then more recently, it's having a bit of a, I don't know, I guess a renaissance. And I think it has mostly to do with the fact that it's become accessible, in that none of us are really up to going to the same extremes and lengths that somebody like William Burroughs would have gone to. He incidentally went there because he thought it might be a cure for his heroin addiction. But none of us are probably willing to go quite as far as he was, because he was going through sort of uncharted territories and trying to find shamans who would help him try this drug that really Westerners weren't commonly doing. So now, though, there are more well-traversed routes for people to go. The thing that I did was actually a package deal, and that's what made me interested in it. It came in my email inbox one day, and it was this offer to go and enjoy the nature reserve in the Tambopata at Rainforest Adventures. And you could sort of adjust the package to do whatever you wanted, wildlife spotting, more of a sort of a spa treatment, and one of the spa treatment packages was ayahuasca, and I actually found it kind of hilarious.
That is so funny. Sort of all-inclusive, you wear this bracelet and get all your drinks and meals free and a dose of ayahuasca.
I know. That's exactly it. I thought it was sort of funny that they were offering it in this way because I had read just a tiny bit about ayahuasca before, and what I'd read was almost horrific, you know, this sort of idea of purging, and I had read that people have fairly extreme bodily reactions to it. So that paradox sort of got me interested.
Well, what was it like for you, Christine?
You know, again, I wouldn't want to endorse it for a lot of people either, necessarily. It was a little scary at first, and we felt we were in extremely good hands where we were. But it was kind of, nonetheless, still a little bit terrifying, especially since a lot of people feel like they're dying when it first goes in.
And you did too, didn't you?
I did. I totally did.
You had the typical purge reaction. There's a lot of vomiting.
Yeah, not so much. Not as much as you hear. But I was checking my pulse before. And then when I did throw up, I was really relieved to do so because I felt like I was getting some of the poison out of my body.
But do you think you ever came to whatever state or, you know, place of diagnostic possibility that you were told could come out of this experience?
Well, the reports are really wide-ranging about what people experience. And some people say that they get nothing less than a full-on sort of religious experience with insights into the origin of the universe. I didn't have that or anything close to that. Other people say that they get insights into their primary relationships. I wouldn't say I necessarily had exactly that either. I think that a lot of what I felt was sort of actually things that you could figure out pretty easily on your own, but I did think I felt them kind of more profoundly, like, you know, you should try to be a better person. You should try to be more generous with people, those sorts of things. So they were actually kind of banalities, I would say, but I felt them very strongly.
Now, you talked about primary relationships. Your husband was also with you on this trip, I guess I can use that word,
yeah,
of various different sorts. What was the experience like for him?
Well, it was pretty hilarious. He had been sick the year before, and I had forgotten to mention that to the shaman. So that kind of added to my concern that this was a really, really stupid thing to have done when I was first doing it. But he was just sort of lying there, and I thought, oh, no, I've killed him. I've taken him into the jungle and killed him. And then the shaman asked if we wanted a second dose, and I said, no, 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 I'm great. And he said, yeah, I'll take a second dose. Anyhow, he had a good experience, but I would say he felt less of the sort of, oh, I should fix my life kind of things that I did. I also felt very strongly that that the stress that we all experience, it could be manageable, that I could feel in some way. That was probably the biggest thing that I took out of it, which was that bodily stress, I could probably work harder to make that a less terrible experience. And I felt like it was possible. And I've never really noticed that before.
Hmm. Now, this was put together by Rainforest Expeditions, this package.
That's right.
You're writing in that Peru is not simply taking money from tourists and investing it in conservation. So what are they trying to do? What about this was a rainforest or eco tour kind of enforcing experience for you?
Well, Rainforest Expeditions is basically almost 100% indigenous owned. There's a lease partnership for a short period of time with a company from Lima that helped them sort of get off the ground and figure out how to offer these sort of services. And ayahuasca is by no means the most popular service that they're offering. But the lease ends, and at some point it will go entirely back to the indigenous community. And what I think is really interesting about what they're doing there with the ayahuasca, with the nature tourism, with the animal spotting, all of it, is that they're making that land more valuable to preserve than to exploit. And as you probably know, the price of gold has made that area very volatile. There's concerns about mercury poisoning from the way that the gold is being extracted. And so the antidote to that is ecotourism, for all that it has its faults, and serious faults they are. At least that's something that provides an incentive to preserve the rainforest as opposed to just exploit it.
Christine Sismondo, an author who writes mostly about America's long relationship with alcohol. Her article about drug tourism in Peru appeared in the Smart Set. Christine, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
And from druggy vacations to chilling booze. When Word of Mouth continues, we'll look into an emerging trend among cocktail enthusiasts, artisanal ice. You can chill on that until Word of Mouth returns right after the break. This is Word of Mouth for New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Not all ice is created equal. When you order a pricey craft cocktail made with fresh-squeezed juices and infused liquors, do you really want to drink it with cloudy lumps of ice cubes that came out of a nozzle? How déclassé. Yes, indeed, we are entering the age of artisanal ice. But like all things small batch and handmade, it is a retro thing, hearkening back to the advent of the cold cocktail and its essential ice cube. The writer Camper English followed the chilly, alcohol-soaked history of the ice cube and wrote about it in Freezer Harvest, A History of Ice Cubes for ModernFarmer.com. Camper English, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
The South is known for its mint juleps and Pimp's Cups and, of course, the Caribbean daiquiris and mojitos and other cold cocktails. Apparently, we have an American entrepreneur to thank for all those. Who is it?
That's Frederick Tudor, the man who more or less created the ice industry. He came up with the idea to harvest pond ice from lakes and ponds around New England and to export it around the world to as far away as India from Massachusetts.
When was he doing this?
We started around 1800, and from 1800 to around 1830 was the buildup of the ice industry as it came to be. And that changed everything, not just in cocktails, but with refrigeration. It really brought new technology to the world.
Well, I'm thinking ice harvesting. These are these big, giant blocks of ice that are getting shipped around and kept in ice houses and cold boxes. Where did the ice cube come from?
Well, the cube came when you would break down these big blocks originally and into smaller bits usable in drinks or for cooling in general. So you mentioned the julep before. Julep would be made from the shavings that came off of a big block, perhaps when you were sewing up a larger block into smaller ones, and you'll have all that shaved or crushed ice, we would say. That's the right ice for a julep, and that's pretty much how the julep came about.
So today, when a bartender asks if you want to drink straight up or on the rocks, back then it was actually the composition of the ice that was crucial to the cocktail.
Yeah, there was a lot of different sizes of ice for different types of drinks. Old cocktail books would specify one or two lumps of ice. Mm-hmm. I don't think we have lumps very often from commercial ice machines. But
well, yeah, that is so interesting. But did they not mix drinks before the ice cube?
Well, they absolutely mixed drinks and cocktails before ice became popular in drinks. But the early recipes would say water instead of today we would always say ice. So the original definition for the cocktail from 1806 is when it was first defined in America was a concoction of spirits, sugar, bitters, and water. And today we would say ice.
Mm. What kind of drinks were born out of this late ice age, I guess?
Well, the whole concept of cooling drinks really came out of ice being available in drinks, and particularly in the southern part of the U.S. Ice coming from New England and Massachusetts in particular was being shipped around and hitting ports like New Orleans in particular. And so many cocktails were born in New Orleans, like the Sazerac. The julep was born in the South as well with those ice shavings, as we had mentioned. The cobbler is another drink that came along with cobblestone size little pieces of ice that fell off the blocks and so on. But ice is one thing that helped define American drinks. And when American drinks spread out from America to the rest of the world, the two things that made them American were the use of bitters in cocktails as well as the use of ice.
Wow. Well, now that classic cocktails are really in vogue, how strictly are bartenders adhering to the recipes, which sometimes actually call for different kinds of authentic ice?
Well, it's really fun in a lot of places. Like there's a bar drink in Boston where they have a great big block of ice on the back bar. And if you want a julep or a cobbler, they will chop off a big piece and put it in a bag and smash it with a mallet to get it to the size of the appropriate size ice for the drink that you have ordered. So it gets pretty nerdy. And also people are insisting on a clarity in their ice for great big clear ice cubes that you can't really make at your home refrigerator.
How are people getting these big huge blocks of ice?
For the most part, people order them from ice companies, and these ice companies use a type of machine that produces blocks for ice sculptures. And those, the way they're able to freeze clear is by using running water, so there's no pockets for the air trapped within the water to freeze and make the cloudiness in the ice, as well as they all have much better filtration for the water so that there's less any trapped impurities in the ice as well.
So could we conceivably make clear ice like this at home?
There is a way, and it's a way that I helped, I don't know, promote and develop. And it's a really simple way, but it takes up a lot of space in your freezer. If you take a hard-sided picnic cooler, like an igloo lunch cooler, and fill that with water, leave the lid off, and put it in your freezer, the ice now will freeze only from the top down, because all the other sides are insulated. And this will push any trapped air and impurities towards the bottom as it freezes, because ice would prefer to be clear if given the choice. And so the first part of the ice that freezes will all be perfectly clear, and only the bottom in this cooler would be cloudy. So you can either let it freeze all the way and chop off the cloudy bottom, or you can just not let it freeze all the way and have a perfectly clear big slab of ice, which then you'll need to use some new ice pick skills to cut it down into the size of cubes that will fit your glass.
And you have to have a lot of people over, I guess, for drinkies. Camper English, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Camper English is a freelance writer. We found his article, Freezer Harvest, A History of Ice Cubes, in modernfarmer.com. Not all of New England's natural ice producers went out of business with the advent of refrigeration. Last year, NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown visited Camp Rocky Wall Deep Haven on the north end of Squam Lake for their 115th annual ice harvest.
John Jersinski, the co-manager of Rocky Wall Deep Haven Camps, oversees a team of about 14 helpers cutting grid patterns into 12-inch thick ice and breaking off the squares like chunks of a Hershey bar. The squares are floated into a channel, prodded into a queue with long hooked poles where they bob in place, waiting to be hauled away.
Grab five blocks at a time, bring them up on the ramp, slide them into the back of the truck, load the truck up, and bring it to one of our two ice houses. We have two or three folks in that ice house packing it tight against each other.
During the summer, camp staff bring ice around in wheelbarrows every morning to the camp's guests. New Englanders have been doing this kind of ice cutting since the late 1700s, and the ice trade took off in the mid-19th century. Ice harvested here used to be shipped to the Caribbean, South America, even India and Australia. It was packed into the lining of chilled rail cars and gave birth to trade in perishable foodstuffs. Rocky Wall started harvesting at the end of the 1800s, right about the time that mechanical refrigeration was starting to spell the end of the New England ice trade. But they didn't stop. And Jersinski says they aren't planning on stopping anytime soon.
Here in the 1970s, they tried putting a few refrigerators in some of the cottages, and guests didn't go for it at all. It's the ambiance. It's very nice to be able to go back in time.
Of course, the way ice is harvested has changed.
I'm Norman Lyford.
So how long have you been doing this?
68 years.
When Lyford started, they were using a horse to pull the ice blocks up into the truck instead of a winch. And the saw that they used to cut the ice was a bit more primitive.
We used to have a one-lunger. We used to have filled it with water, keep it cool.
A one-lunger?
Yeah.
I don't know. What's that mean?
It used to be, that's what they, years ago, they used to have for motors. Mm-hmm. They called them one-lunger. They just one spark plug.
Right.
One cylinder.
Yeah.
Despite the modern winches and saws and the two flatbed trucks to haul the ice, it takes 3 days of solid work to fill the camp's two ice houses. That gives enough ice to stock 62 ice boxes all year round. Dave White lives in an off-the-grid house one town over. He helps out with the harvest in exchange for being able to fill up his own miniature ice house. For him, that ice is a zero-electricity way to keep his food cold. And while this year's warmth has got him worried, he's not giving up.
It may be an act of faith for Rocky Wold, even, to continue to have an ice harvest. And I guess if they're willing, I'm willing.
The ice harvest this year went off without a hitch. Well, one small hitch. They had to stop in the middle to plow the lake after a blizzard dumped 14 inches of snow onto the ice field. No bother, says John Jersinski. The blizzard just turned nice ice skating conditions into nice cross-country skiing conditions.
Thanks to Sam Evans-Brown for that story. Stay with us for the story of a man who brazenly took on the heartbleed hysteria by posting his online passwords for all the world to see. That's when Word of Mouth continues. But first, the news.
Word of
Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The online bug Heartbleed created a massive security hole and sent throngs of people scrambling to change their passwords, sparking paranoia along the way. Now we bring you a story from the TLDR podcast about a man who boldly stared down Heartbleed and posted his online passwords for all the world to see.
On Monday, someone who calls themselves Y. Woodman Brown left this comment on a Washington Post article about the Heartbleed bug. Quote, I couldn't give a flying fig about the Heartbleed thingamajig. 2 years already this thing's been running loose, and not a word of someone crying over its damage. Say, does anybody really know its origin? Russian crackers? Seattle high schoolers? The NSA? Yahoo's marketing department? Read all the email that I have. Sneak into my WAPO, NYT, or CNN accounts and go crazy making comments in my name. Break into my Facebook and Twitter profiles and change my hometown to Gas City, Indiana. Swap out my avatar with a picture of your nads. Make friends with people I don't know. He then posted two passwords he uses across most of his online presence. Other posters warned him this was probably not the brightest idea, and the Washington Post quickly removed the comment, but it's really not difficult to figure out what happened next. Within hours, people had gotten control of his Facebook, his Tumblr, his WordPress blog, his DeviantArt account. The person who took control of his Twitter account changed his location to Gas City, Indiana. Washington Post writer Brian Fung spun an entire article out of Y. Woodman Brown's comment, using it as a cautionary tale on internet security hubris. I knew I had to get in touch with him, but I didn't really know where to begin. Online, Y. Woodman Brown's a bit of a cipher. He has a robust online presence. He leaves comments all over the place. On sports sites, on political sites, he's on Huffington Post, and of course he's on the Washington Post. But there's barely any information about who he actually is out there on the internet. And try as I might, I couldn't find an email address for him. So I tried getting in touch with the people I knew would be most likely to have his personal info. The folks who hijacked his accounts.
Hello.
Hi, this is Alex. How you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
This is Katie. She now controls Y. Woodman Brown's Twitter account. I don't know anything about her other than that she's a college student and she thinks this is all very funny.
All I did was take someone's password and log into their account and take their Twitter and, I guess if you want to interview me for that, that's awesome.
So if you could do me a favor, could you tell me how you found out about Woodman Brown?
So everyone's heard of the whole Heartbleed bug thing. So I typed it into Google and I found a news article on it. And I was looking at the comments because comments are always pretty amusing to look at. And there was one that stood out and this guy, and he's being like, "Ah, all you Americans are so paranoid, you know, everyone's freaking out." And okay, I understand that. But then he did this thing where he put his passwords on his comment and said, "Hey, come hack me," or whatever, you know, hacking, whatever it is. And I was like, that's not real, but I'm just going to try it. And I tried it and it worked. I mean, this guy doesn't use his Twitter ever, but it goes back to 2012, I think. And, well, I guess I'd rather take it and post stupid things on it than have someone take it and ruin this guy's life. Because, of course, he doesn't deserve that.
So in a way, you're like a benevolent thief.
I guess so. That fits me pretty well, I guess. A benevolent thief.
What's your plan for this? Are you just going to hang on to it forever? Are you ever going to post on it again?
Well, what I wanted to do last night, this is what I thought of, and I'm still working on it, but take song lyrics, like song lyrics everyone knows, and just modify them about taking a Twitter, taking passwords, and just post a new one every day.
Do you have any ideas so far?
Well, the first one should be from My Heart Will Go On, because that is a great song. That's a fantastic song. Come on.
So one of the things I wanted to do as part of this was get in touch with Woodman Brown, but I have no idea how to contact him. So I'm curious, since you have the keys to his Twitter account, do you know how I could get in touch with him?
I can give you his email, but I'm guessing it's been compromised. I'm guessing most of the things have been compromised.
Yeah, if you could give me his email, that would be amazing. In my perfect world, in my dream, the way that this story ends is with me finding Y. Woodman Brown. And in a double extra perfect world, Y. Woodman Brown will say, I'm totally unrepentant about this. I'm totally don't regret having done this. I think it was a great idea.
Yes. Yeah. Oh my God. That'd be hilarious. I hope he just responds with YOLO.
Katie passed along an email address and I sent an email that began, dear person who's probably taken over Y. Woodman Brown's email account, in the hopes that they could lead me back to the man himself. So I was surprised when I got this email back. It read, Alex, nobody took over my account. That's my point. Real criminals aren't out there hijacking Gmail accounts. Only pranksters. And only when you freaking invite them. Otherwise, you're perfectly safe. And that is how I met Woody Brown.
In the olden days, nobody even locked their front doors, not in the neighborhood that I grew up in. And the choice is either live behind the locked door or don't. And to me, freedom is choosing not to live behind the locked door.
You know, I think that the way that this story was told on the internet was sort of an idiot who posted his password and then got his comeuppance. Does it bother you that that's the way that that story was told?
I expect it. It's the conventional view. I suppose I did get my comeuppance, if you consider that somebody then walked into my accounts on Facebook and added an extra page that said, boy, are you stupid. I don't know. I'm inviting you in. I don't think that some Russian mob guy who invents something like the heartbleed bug is going to waste his time looking for my money. I think he's after bigger fish to fry. I think that what I'm risking is teenage prank. Ha ha ha, I've tagged your account. And what does that amount to?
But, you know, you exist online as Y. Woodman Brown, which is your real name. And when I found your name, I looked all over the internet and I found comments by you. And you gave people the keys to write on the internet as you. Weren't you concerned about your reputation as Y. Woodman Brown?
No, I guess not. I guess not. I suppose if Y. Woodman Brown was actually somebody in this world, I might have thought twice. But since I'm just your average Joe, that didn't occur to me.
I'm actually curious, if you don't mind telling me, I found your presence all over the internet, but there's very little on it about you. It's mostly you commenting on things. And I was curious, you know, who you are, not, you know, your address, but where you live and sort of what you do. You don't have to tell me if you don't want to.
No, that's okay. I'm just a technical writer.
And what do you do with your free time?
What do I do with my free time?
I'm so interested in the person who gave his passwords on Washington Post. I just think that it takes a level of bravery that I couldn't begin to muster. I think that what you did was so courageous, even though to you it just seemed like an act of, I'd say, defiance, maybe?
I guess during most of life, I'm a low-risk guy because you won't find me bungee jumping. and you won't find me doing clips that show up on Tosh.0. Believe me, I'm not daring enough to try that stuff and end up causing me a Tosh-worthy accident. I know a bit what you mean about bravery. There was this movie that came out, I don't know how old you would have been. It's, how long ago was it? Good Morning Vietnam.
Oh, I remember that. It was from the late 80s, I think.
Yeah, okay. So the moment that defines the movie, actually, there's a scene where Robin Williams is teaching English as a second language to a group of people. He's talking to an elderly man, and he's saying to this elderly man, I'm attacking you. I have a spoon, and I'm attacking you with my spoon. What do you do? So he says, I'm sitting here. I do nothing. And Robin Williams says, well, I'm coming after you. I've got my spoon. I'm going for you. I'm about to kill you. And the man said something like, then I am dying. What he's saying is, I subscribe to peace. So if you truly have the incivility to attack me to the point of death, then what I'm doing is, I'm dying. Real bravery is staying committed to your principles, even if it means your own death. That's quite extreme. I'm not sure that I'm that far along, but I understand the theory.
Wow. You took me on a real journey with that answer. Now comes the confession period of this discussion. The way I found your email address is that I actually reached out to the person who hijacked your Twitter account.
Oh, that's okay. You don't get to be 53 and put your password on the Washington Post and not expect that something's going to happen.
And that story was produced by PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman for the TLDR podcast. In case you're wondering, TLDR means too long, didn't read. When Word of Mouth continues, we're going to talk about a strange pairing, Soviet spies from the critically acclaimed FX series The Americans and Cold Warrior Oliver North.
He's very aware that he remains a polarizing figure, and even when the Americans producers came to him and said, would you like to participate in this, he did warn them. He sort of compared himself to the Pigpen character from Peanuts, the Peanuts comic strip, that he said, you know, there's this sort of cloud of dust that follows me around.
We'll hear more about his role on the show after a break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Reagan-era Cold War is the setting for The Americans, an espionage drama now in its second season on FX. The series follows Elizabeth and Philip, a pair of Soviet spies living undercover with their children in the D.C. suburbs. One of the plot lines this season centers on the U.S. government's covert efforts to arm and train the Contras in Nicaragua. Here, an informant clues an incognito Elizabeth in on the plans.
There's been a change of plans. I'm not going to be at the meet with the Contra brass.
Why not?
I'm leaving for Nicaragua.
For how long?
Hard to say. 6 months. Maybe longer.
What's the rush?
We're setting up a Contra base at the Selva Negra Cloud Forest.
What's there?
Butterflies. Monarchs. It's where they breed.
The series producers developed the Contra plot with none other than Oliver North, who was a central figure in the Iran-Contra scandal. North even gets a story credit on tomorrow night's episode. He is currently a conservative political commentator and television host who still incites partisan passions 30 years after the scandal. David Itzkoff, culture reporter for The New York Times, wrote the article, Oliver North, Now in the Service of TV's KGB. David Itzkoff, welcome to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Can you summarize for us in a very brief way the role that Oliver North played in this Iran-Contra scandal?
In the scandal itself, I wish I could summarize it in the length of a single radio program. But the role, of course, is that at the same time that the United States basically had a trade embargo with Iran, it was also selling arms to Iran and then using some of those funds or using a part of those proceeds to go to the Contras in Nicaragua who were opposing the Marxist Sandinista government there. So that was part of what North was involved in.
He was convicted in 1989 of crimes stemming from his involvement, including destroying documents, the obstruction of Congress. Later suspended, as you write, all charges dismissed. I remember these televised hearings seeming to be on television for a very long time. So North was a kind of a hero to some and personification of power run amok among others. How involved is he in developing this storyline for the Americans?
Well, in this particular case with the Americans, the producers, the creator of the show, Joe Weisberg, and his co-executive producer, Joel Fields, as you discussed at the top of the segment, you said that they were starting to develop a storyline about the U.S.'s efforts to help arm the Contras. And as they got further into exploring this, they said, well, we'd really like to speak to somebody who knows this history firsthand and perhaps lived it and who if we reach out to other people within FX and at Fox, which is a big, entertainment and media conglomerate, who else might it lead us to? And it actually then connected them to Oliver North, who is an on-air host and personality at Fox News. So certainly there you've got somebody who knows the subject matter pretty well, better than almost anybody else still with us. So they just wanted to explore ideas with him, and he helped them come up with a storyline that you will see in further detail on Wednesday. Don't want to spoil it too much. But it involves, Philip and Elizabeth trying to infiltrate a Contra training camp. And so all the detail that they got from North about how that camp would be operated, how somebody with nefarious intentions might try to break into that camp, even if you encountered soldiers on that camp and can just sort of overhear the kind of banter that they might engage in, all of that they were getting via North. And after all the consulting that he did and all the info that he gave them, they felt that that was worth giving him a story credit on that episode.
Well, David, you interviewed Oliver North about his consultation. Now, did he understand that his participation could stir up quite a dust cloud?
I think he does. I mean, he's participated in other kinds of cultural projects. He continues to write military thrillers and novels. And even through his participation on Fox News, he's very aware that he remains a polarizing figure. And even when the Americans' producers came to him and said, would you like to participate in this, he did warn them. He said, I am the kind of person who he sort of compared himself to the Pigpen character from Peanuts, the Peanuts comic strips, that he said, there's this sort of cloud of dust that follows me around. But that obviously was not a significant enough to the concern to the Americans' producers, and so they, of course, were happy to draw on the body of knowledge that he possesses.
Which is interesting because Joe Weisberg, who you mentioned, one of the showrunners, he is himself a former CIA operative, right? And so how accurately is that particular era of Cold War politics portrayed?
Well, I think that the producers would be the first to tell you they take a certain license with not necessarily history. I mean, they want to be accurate to the history of the 1980s, but obviously Philip and Elizabeth are not people who ever really existed, and so that gives them a certain poetic license and also a lens
through which they can see events that already occurred, that because we're following the path of these characters who we know eventually do not prevail, it lets us kind of look at activities that our own government engaged in at this time and what America was doing sort of on a global stage and think about it and think, well, you know, how do we feel about these events now and how might these characters with their sort of dual loyalties, how might they feel about it? And North himself is actually, you know, he really enjoys the show and was very happy to participate despite the fact that it is about characters who are KGB spies because to North it really embodies everything that President Reagan was trying to do to stop the Soviet Union and to prevent them from you know, eclipsing the United States on the superpower stage. And so to whatever extent the TV show illuminates that, North was very happy with.
Yeah, of course, this is the evil empire era, right?
Exactly, exactly.
Now, you also spoke to critics of the decision to consult with Oliver North. What are some of those objections?
Well, I think the larger objection, I mean, part of it stems with the fact that I think people still feel uncomfortable that, that North's own place in history is somewhat unresolved. That, yes, he, of course, was, you know, all the charges against him were dropped, but yet some people still seem to feel that for whatever reason he didn't sort of, you know, pay whatever price was, you know, demanded of him for his actions during Iran-Contra. And certainly, I mean, that was a very scandalous period of history, and at least through the eyes of these people, he is essentially profiting from his own scandal, that now he can go out and, you know, participate and contribute to TV shows that, that draw upon it, and he can be involved in, you know, other creative projects that, you know, it's sort of, you know, you're basically getting rewarded for a period of American history that a lot of people still are not very proud of and that people don't quite have a sense of, you know, is it something that we're going to continue to look back on with pride or with a kind of shame?
In fact, the editor, the literary editor of the New Republic told you that it was, he kind of characterized it as a continued attempt to aggrandize and whitewash his role in the Iran-Contra scandal. Did you come away with an impression of what was motivating North? Was he trying to manage his image historically?
You know, I just sat down with him for about an hour at the offices of the Americans, which are over in Gowanus in Brooklyn, not exactly the most glamorous place, but he really seems to be having a great time there. I mean, he still has this kind of megawatt smile. You can very easily see why he has succeeded as an on-air TV personality. And I think he's kind of amused by, you know, all the back and forth that continues to go on. And if it does sort of put it back out in front of people, this period of American history, I think it pleases him. I think he's found in his own sort of globe-trotting explorations of the world and continuing to go into combat zones for Fox News, there's a whole generation of Americans who actually have no idea who he is, who maybe are, you know, only 20 or 25 years old and didn't live through that period of American history and just don't even know of him as anything other than a broadcaster. So the fact that it reminds them or immerses them in this period, I think he's very happy about.
David Itzkoff, thank you so much for joining us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
David Itzkoff is a culture reporter for The New York Times. You will find a link to read his article, Oliver North, Now in the Service of TV's KGB. We have a link at wordofmouthradio.org. How about you? Are you watching The Americans? Will Oliver North's involvement change that? Did you live through the evil empire era and the Iran-Contra hearings? Is Oliver North's involvement bound to be self-aggrandizing, whitewashing? Or should we just allow political bygones to be political bygones? You can let us know on our Facebook page at Word of Mouth Radio or on Twitter at Word of Mouth. Thank you so much for joining us today. If you do like what you heard, there is much more to browse through at wordofmouthradio.org. Earlier in the show, we discussed the emerging trend among the mixologists set of artisanal ice. Now, if you're thinking that is ridiculous or ice cubes are just ice cubes, think again. We do have a slideshow of some gorgeous crystal clear cocktail ice in all kinds of shapes and sizes. That's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org, and it is worth a gander. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on NHPR, New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.